Hello, welcome to episode 36 of Is This Democracy? And to part two of our conversation about Landslide, the fantastic new NPR podcast series created by Ben Bradford, and about the story Landslide tells, about the transformation of politics in the 1970s, the emergence of a new kind of populist politics, how the Republican Party was taken over by right-wing radicalism that ultimately rose to power with Ronald Reagan in 1980, and how all that relates to what we are experiencing today. If you haven't yet, I recommend you go back to last week's episode and part one of this conversation with not only Ben Bradford, who created, produced, hosted, and narrated Landslide, but also with my friend and fellow historian Seth Kotler, who is working on a book project about the relationship between establishment republicanism and the far right, which is in many ways also what's at the heart of the story that Landslide tells. I properly introduced both Ben and Seth at the beginning of last week's part one. I just want to reiterate that I am so happy with how this conversation turned out. Both Seth and Ben are such thoughtful people, and they have really grappled deeply with these issues we talk about here. If you are interested in the recent history of American politics and the prehistories of our present and how we got to where we are today, I promise this conversation is for you. In part one last week, we already talked about the process of partisan sorting and party realignment, certainly one of the key stories in recent U.S. history, about the reaction of the Republican Party establishment to the Reagan-led right-wing insurgency that oscillated between arrogance, helplessness, and complicity. We discussed Reagan as a radical figure in U.S. history and why we can only understand the rise of these right-wing insurgents if we focus on the racial and cultural grievances around which their political project was organized. In this part two here, we start by tackling the question of how to reconcile individual agency and structural contexts, presidential politics and grassroots activism, the contingencies of the political process, and broader cultural and ideological shifts when we think about history, when we think about how we want to tell the story of the past. We also reflect on the question of how to relate Ronald Reagan to Donald Trump, on the relationship between the political styles, promises, and projects they embody, Reaganism and Trumpism, on the similarities and echoes, but also the differences between these two brands of reactionary politics. And finally, we reflect on the lessons we ought to learn, or maybe not learn, from the 1970s for our own political moment, and whether the story of Gerald Ford is best interpreted as a role model for a more moderate politics oriented towards compromise, or as a cautionary tale of what happens when the Republican establishment tries to appease and harness, rather than oppose, the forces of right-wing extremism. So much good stuff packed into this episode. Again, I'm very grateful to both Seth Kotler and Ben Bradford for having this conversation with me. Please check out Landslide wherever you get your podcasts. Support the work of Ben Bradford, the work he does with his podcast production studio, Nuance Tales. You'll find links in the show notes. And please, if you haven't done so yet, subscribe to Is This Democracy? If you are feeling particularly generous, you might even leave us a rating or a review, which helps us tremendously. As always, this show is produced by Connor Lynch, and we are grateful to him for making all this good stuff happen. If you have any feedback, please email us at isthisdemocracypod@gmail.com. And now here's part two of our conversation about Landslide with Ben Bradford and Seth Kotler. So I want to change gears a little bit and talk about sort of presidential politics and telling history in a podcast and about sort of narrative storytelling in audio form. So Ben, early on in Landslide, you state pretty clearly that the protagonists of this story are Gerald Ford, Ronald Reagan, and Jimmy Carter. So that means the focus of Landslide is very much on the level of presidential politics, rather than, say, on the level of grassroots activism, for instance. They're in there, right? You're not ignoring it, but it's not the focus of your series. And it also means that this is a story that focuses on, or a history that turns on, individual actions, agency, on contingencies, right? What if this particular decision by the Carter campaign had gone differently? What if this particular vote at the Republican convention would have come out differently? That sort of thing, right? Rather than on more structural factors and contexts. So this is a problem that historians obviously grapple with all the time, how to reconcile those different levels and elements between more contingency, individual action, individual figures versus the broader sort of structural systemic context. That's the thing. I'm curious to hear how you approached this problem, how you wrestled with that challenge. Because again, I wouldn't even ask it if I felt like you haven't done any wrestling with that, because you have those broader structural things in there, right? Those different levels. I think you did a really good job with sort of kind of reconciling that. But again, you decided here's where the focus is. So how did that process go? How did you get to that point?
Yeah. Well, let me say, first of all, I think that a reasonable critique of the series that I could see would be saying that it leans too much into sort of the great man theory of history, and that it says that, you know, these people made these changes and it happened. I mean, I agree with you. I tried to sort of look at the push pull between the people and you know, these very high profile politicians and, you know, the other things that are sort of working at the time. But I could see that critique, and I think we should discuss it. And I would love to kind of get further into that. In terms of how I approached it, I think that you have to pick a lens, right? History is a continuum, and where do you stop and where do you start? Every story's got to start somewhere. It's got to stop somewhere. And particularly for audio storytelling, and this is the thing I've really had to learn, people just can't hold that many names in their head. So I had this problem when I started my first series of The People, which is the Audible series about McGovern. And the first episode, you know, I'm telling people, and this guy, you guys will be able to sort this out because you're historians, but for most people who aren't going to be familiar with all the names, I start with this moment in 1968, Lyndon Johnson is president. He gets challenged by Eugene McCarthy. And then Robert F. Kennedy jumps in, sort of undercuts McCarthy a little bit, running anti-war. Lyndon Johnson drops out. Hubert Humphrey jumps in and for Lyndon Johnson. And then Robert F. Kennedy gets assassinated and George McGovern jumps in for Robert F. Kennedy. Then we go to the convention where you have Humphrey, McCarthy, and McGovern. And I was trying to sort of hand off between one to the other, but it was still, it's like, these are five names and they're in some ways famous names and in some ways not. Most people won't know Humphrey these days, even though he was, you know, incredibly famous and popular as a senator, and then incredibly famous, but less popular as a vice president. And it's very hard. So you have to really sort of narrow it down, which is one of the reasons that you don't necessarily hear a lot about the names of the advisors of the presidents during our series. Unless, like, there's a very specific moment, you will very rarely hear me say, you know, this person in the campaign did this thing and then the campaign made this turn. You just hear, you know, Ford does this or Reagan does that. Because ultimately, they're the people responsible for these organizations. But my idea was, let's look at this through the lens of our most high-profile races. You know, let's look at the changes that happen in the country and the changes to the political party, and let's see how those happen through these stories. And I think there are a lot of other ways to look at it. I think that, like, looking at it through the perspective, as Seth is doing, of Walter Huss, sounds absolutely fascinating and absolutely illuminating. And it'll share a lot of the same things that we'll see happen, you know, sort of the bigger forces in American politics that allow us to get to where we are today. And then there will be other aspects that, you know, I don't get into, and vice versa. So I think you have to choose your lens. A thing that I am really interested in, and this is a thing that I would love to get your guys' perspective on, is the degree to which candidates influence what voters think. And so to me, this is sort of the build the wall thing, where build the wall in 2016, Trump is one of 17 candidates running for the nomination. And the idea of build the wall, it's like the Panama Canal. People are like, this is a ridiculous idea. No credible person would want to spend, you know, that much concrete and many billions of dollars building, you know, a great wall along the southern border. And it's an outlandish idea. And then, of course, by the time the Republican nomination comes, build the wall is in the platform. And it becomes this sort of policy symbol that's widely supported in the Republican Party. And that doesn't happen without that particular candidate. And I think that there are moments like that that I see throughout the 1976 race. The Panama Canal is one of them. But, you know, I think that there are breaks that, let's say, Ronald Reagan catches, certainly that Jimmy Carter catches. And you have to ask yourself, if those things don't happen, what does the country look like? And I think it is an open question. Does it, you know, do we get to where we are today? Do the parties take the shape that they do? if those things don't happen, you know, maybe because of the mass movements that are happening underneath them, those things are inevitable. But it also seems to me that there are just these moments with these people who are the standard bearers for these movements. And if things play out a little bit differently, we don't necessarily get things that are the same shape. You know, if Ronald Reagan is facing somebody other than Jimmy Carter in 1980, that race probably looks a whole lot different. Because of just how disliked Jimmy Carter was at that point in time. So I don't know. I think it's sort of that balance was something that I really kind of struggled with. And I'm absolutely fascinated by the story itself, you know, by the chess match and the boxing match that is Ford versus Reagan and Ford versus Carter and Reagan versus Carter. And they are just incredible stories. And that appeals to me, the degree to which, you know, you have the comebacks and this person looks like they're on their last legs. And then all of a sudden they have this resurgence. And there's this idea of Reagan's former campaign manager who helped him win the governorship working for Gerald Ford and finding the little thing that he just knows is going to piss off Reagan. And that's the thing that both campaigns credit for creating Reagan's stumbles in the early primaries. That's amazing to me. And it's funny and it's hilarious. So I certainly from a storytelling perspective, you want to lean into those things. But there is a juggling. So I don't know exactly how to strike that balance. And I would love to hear your guys' thoughts on that.
There's something that you do in the podcast that I thought was really interesting, which is the sound of the printers buzzing courses throughout. And I thought that was a really effective audio kind of thing for me listening to it, because it gives you this, it's kind of ominous, you know, it's in the background, but because I do what I do and I study who I study, I just imagined the reams of this direct mail that was in Walter Huss's archive, right? That he was getting and he was reading. So talk a bit about that, about the decision. How did you decide to do that? And what was the kind of idea behind that kind of piece of the ambient kind of design of the podcast?
Yeah. So the direct mail thing obviously is a huge piece of it. And the degree to which all of these different organizations that gain the name, the New Right, are sort of organizing via direct mail, sending out letters to people. And these letters in some cases are really apocalyptic. And they're sort of a predecessor to, I think, a lot of conservative media today. And you hear people who were involved in it say that. So part of it was, again, this idea of like audio storytelling and how are we going to get people to remember? I mean, that episode where we first introduced the printers and we introduced the New Right has a lot of moving pieces. There's a lot of names you have to remember. And I think I've gotten better at this over time. You know, you have to remember the New Right. We talk about Richard Viguerie, who's the great publisher, direct mail guru, who is the architect of a lot of this. You know, I'm trying to explain, okay, you have these textbook protests in West Virginia. You have the Boston busing riots. You have all of these other fires around the country that are mobilizing people, and they're being mobilized. And how is that happening? This idea of the, sort of the interconnected web. And so one analogy that we use is sort of the forest of aspen trees. But the other thing is, well, then we're going to take a break from them for a while. And we're going to talk about campaign finance, and we're going to talk about Reagan's campaign's doldrums. And then we're going to talk about the comeback. And what is a thing that will help us remember what we're hearing just when we're doing this audio storytelling? And so that was sort of where the idea of the printers came out, is just what is a cue that might help people remember what we're dealing with? You know, you hear this all the time in sort of more explanatory podcasts, again, sort of like the Planet Money thing. We used to do these kind of things on Marketplace, where people will do, you know, there are three ideas that about the economy. Idea one, ding, right? And they have a little ding sound and people are like, oh yeah. And you explain the idea one and then you go over and it's idea two, ding. It's like, oh yeah, that's right. There are three ideas. So played around with that. And I will say there was another version of this where we also have these other analogies. We have the aspen trees. We've got the river of people, where we had a more maximalist sound design. And we tried, okay, well, maybe we have the branches of the trees growing. We have, you know, the river flowing. And I was like, okay, this is too much. We cannot have this. And then that became really useful later on, because we do have the New Right involved in George Wallace's campaign. We have, you know, the New Right and then the Christian Right and sort of the interplay between those two later on. And I have to also just credit, like, I have a sound designer, Jay Siebold, who was just killer on figuring those things out. And so that was the general idea behind it, though, was a cue for people to sort of remember this force. And the idea of sort of the dot matrix printer was one that was sort of evocative to me. And then the way he executed it became like, oh, well, we're going to use this more. So I think that sort of, you know, then organically kind of showed up in later episodes.
I mean, I love hearing you talk about this, how the medium sort of shapes the how you tell the story, but also the story that you tell, not just how you tell the story. It shapes the story, right?
Yeah.
And I find that interesting and really important to sort of think this through and also grapple with the fact that if you set out to tell the story in a different medium, the end result will be a different story, right? Not a better or worse story, a slightly different story. I just want to say on the very broad thing on sort of individual agency, focus on people and on specific actors versus more structural, more sort of systemic kind of forces. I mean, look, there's these sort of long-standing anti-democratic, anti-pluralistic tendencies and impulses, and there's ideas. You are dealing with ideas and sort of forces that have shaped in many ways the American political tradition, American project since, well, forever, right? Like ideas of freedom, defined as kind of a white freedom, as a freedom to be free from government intervention in your sort of privileges, that sort of thing, right? But it almost lets the individuals that you are looking at off the hook. If you're making the story just about those broader forces, it lets these people off the hook because it pretends their actions, their decisions didn't matter, but they did matter. And so they bear responsibility for their actions, right? Yeah. If they didn't have any agency, then they also have no responsibility, but they do have responsibility. If you look at all this of political science research, it will all tell you elite signaling, right? As just one example, elite signaling matters extremely to what sort of voters, the electorate, the base, what they think is acceptable and not acceptable. This is one of the big things that has changed on the American right. One of the big things that Donald Trump has changed, right? He is constantly signaling to the base, this is acceptable. Can totally do this or say this or behave in this way. That stuff matters. Those decisions matter. And also we should hold them responsible for those decisions. And so that is, again, that's why just because there are also those broader forces doesn't mean these individuals, their agency, their actions, all that doesn't matter. It still matters very much. If you don't mind, I want to sort of zoom out and talk a little bit. This is the last big block, I guess, in our conversation.
Sure.
Talk a little bit about how Landslide, the story you tell, how it relates to today, how we got from there to where we are now. I mean, I guess to think this through a little bit, let's return to Ronald Reagan. How could we not? You have no other choice, basically, after the Trump presidency. You have no other choice but to approach Reagan through the lens of the Trump experience. It is impossible, if you do that, to not notice many similarities or echoes, right, between those two figures. And I think it's fair to say that you emphasize those at certain points, right? So Reagan, we have this radical outsider. He's a crazy celebrity. Observers thought he could never win, but then he did, even though he certainly wasn't always, shall we say, tethered to reality and truth in what he did or said. And he did that by waging this sort of culture war grievance campaign, and he pulled the whole party to the right. So Ben, how do you see Reagan, relate him to Trump? Are we looking at analogous figures in U.S. history? How much Trump was in Reagan? How much Reagan is in Trump? These are big questions, but what are some of your thoughts on this question?
You know, I have many thoughts. I think that, but kind of simply, Reagan is not Trump. In terms of personal style, in terms of sort of personal gentility, right? People talk about Reagan as in terms of his personal style as being unfailingly, you know, kind. And I think that when he was in office, the thing that upset people like Walter Huss was that he showed an ability to compromise. He wanted what he wanted, and he was willing to compromise to get part of what he wanted. Particularly in a divided government. And so the landscape of where we are to a large extent has changed so that's rarer in general. but certainly is a different preference than Trump showed as president, and certainly in his rhetoric. There are a lot of similarities, and I think that in terms of the populism, there's and the forces that were being harnessed and the voters that are being brought over. Right. I mean, that's where you see the similarities between what Reagan was doing and what Donald Trump has done. I would say if you were looking for a better historical analog, probably George Wallace is more similar stylistically to Trump. But I also sort of struggle with those comparisons. You're right that I lean into them sometimes because I think that there's just this these things that hit and you're like, wow, that I can't believe that was being used back then. So one of the moments that really stands out to me is actually Jimmy Carter saying, let's change our country, make it great once again, right? And this idea that, okay, make America great again, in some ways is the slogan of a populist rather than the slogan of a conservative. And this idea of politicians tapping a once great past that we have gotten away from. So I think that those resonances are something that I have certainly put in intentionally. They're usually sort of serendipity in the sense that I came across them and was like, oh, you know, look at that. Like, I think that when Reagan starts using the slogan, make America number one again, I read that in a book about Gerald Ford and the challenges of the 1970s is what it's called. It's a biography of Ford. It was just like, oh, you know, it was written well before 2016. And so I think that those resonances are there and they help remind us that as sort of fraught as our political moment is, and how in some ways it is ahistorical, another way it's, you know, part of a continuum, and a lot of these forces have been with us before. So I don't know that's a great answer to your question, and I actually would love to hear, you know, your guys' perspectives on that. You know, is Reagan Trump? What are the connections, and in what ways are they different?
So this makes me think of, so Rick Perlstein described Reagan's style as a liturgy of absolution. By focusing on Reagan's kind of sunniness, his optimism, his kind of genial personality. And this was all about absolving America of any past sins or ills, right? And this is the kind of, we're post-racial now, right? It's all okay. But there are also these moments in Reagan's career where when he's actually encountering Black political activists, he often just completely loses it.
Yeah. Right?
And kind of becomes hysterical and runs, like, comes out, you know, races out of a room.
Yeah, leaves the stage during a debate. Yeah, right.
But Reagan is speaking to a particular segment of the population, and he's saying to them two things. One, you are the real Americans, and your grievances are real, and I see them. And also, you're completely innocent. Right? You have done nothing wrong. We have done nothing wrong. And so it creates this kind of psyche where people can blend the resentment with a sense of contentment. And what Trump maybe does is he dropped the liturgy of absolution, and it's a liturgy of retribution, right? And it's not as if the retribution wasn't there in the, you know, the Neshoba County Fair speech with Reagan and going after the George Wallace voters in the 1976 primary in Texas, right? So Reagan was not at all using those tactics, but he kind of wrapped it in this smiling package, right? That people took to be the main primary message, right? So like to give another example, I think it's 1980 when he's giving a speech to the evangelicals, and he says something like, now look, a lot of people will disagree with us on this, and I'm sure they do that in good faith, but, right? Yeah. So he's basically saying, like, look, there's a bunch of evil secularists out there who want to destroy America, but I'm sure they're good people.
Yeah.
you know, and everybody heard the, but I'm sure they're good people part. And they missed the fact that he's just like serving red meat to these people who feel completely victimized, right, by secularism, by the existence of people of color and the existence of non-Christians.
I will just say that going through Reagan's rhetoric, a thing that I was struck by is the degree to which that is how he frames almost any issue he talks about. I mean, he is this sort of master of plausible deniability. And the way that he does that is almost always by taking the position that he is opposing and saying, well, of course, nobody could disagree with the idea of, you know, blah, 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 you know, whatever it is that's sort of on the table and at issue. Like, let's take civil rights again. Nobody would disagree with the idea that we should have civil rights. But I just, you know, wonder. And then he says sort of the thing that's sort of devastatingly against it. And it's incredible how often you hear that framing. So then when I'm going through and I'm taking archival footage and saying, well, how do I show you what Reagan's rhetoric is? Sometimes you want to just strip that away and say, well, let's hear the part that's after the but. Is that, I think it's a Game of Thrones line, right? It says, I'm only interested in what comes after the word but. And so I think that it's just funny to hear you say that, because that framing is so prevalent throughout all of the speeches. And once you know that and you go back and you hear it, you'll hear it all the time.
Reagan is certainly key in mainstreaming a certain strand of conspiratorial right-wing extremism. He's also key in sort of mainstreaming and establishing a certain style of celebrity politics that didn't originate with him at all, and doesn't even originate purely on the right. I mean, the Kennedys did a lot to sort of make that a big thing in American politics. He's also kind of supercharging a political culture in which such figures can succeed, even have a massive advantage over their opponents and critics, precisely because they are not bound to norms and truthfulness. I always think of this thing, like this spring 1987, I think Reagan addresses the fact that he flat out lied to Congress and the American people in the Iran-Contra affair. And he says, this is a direct quote. I looked it up before we came on. This is not from memory. I looked it up. This is a quote. A few months ago, I told the American people I did not trade arms for hostages. And then he says, my heart and my best intentions tell me that's true, but the facts and evidence tell me it is not. This is an absolutely astonishing thing to say for an American president who, again, at that point, there's no question what happened there. Like, it's clear he absolutely lied. Forget his feelings and his heart, right? He himself calls it the facts and the evidence. And in hindsight, I think this is one of those moments when someone, the system, should have held Reagan accountable in order to establish that this is not okay, right? This is not something that should happen, but it did happen and he wasn't held accountable, and that matters, right? This establishes this kind of, again, Trump is a very extreme kind of version, and the way he's not been held accountable, this type of Trumpian impunity is a kind of extreme version of this. But again, you have this in 1987, and that is absolutely remarkable that he says that, and like, what in my heart, it's true. But I think on the differences side, beyond everything you've already said, Reagan's brand of reactionary sort of ethno-nationalist nostalgia, it came with sunshine, with kind of positive vibes, right? It was mourning in America is what he talks about. Mourning in America. We can do it, and we're the best, and that's the thing. Trump is almost offering like a kind of a dark, depressed mirror image of that. Everything's terrible. Everything is a disaster. It's American carnage. And so I think, in a way, what Trump is offering, although it is in that sort of tradition, and it has certain, it's not a complete departure, it's not a complete aberration, but it is more, even more geared towards the idea that only one leader can save the country, even more geared towards radical solutions, extreme solutions. And in that sense, I think it's even more dangerous. In any kind of prehistory of Trumpism, in any kind of genealogy of how we get to where we are today, Reagan has to have like a prominent place in that, right? But it's not the same thing, right? It's absolutely not the same thing. And I think that's what makes this sort of relating these two historical figures and phenomena to each other makes us so interesting, I think. We should talk a little bit more about Gerald Ford. We touched on him early on, but let's go get back to Ford as we're coming sort of to the end of our conversation. Because you end Landslide, the season, you end it with a kind of reassessment, and I think it's fair to say reappreciation of Gerald Ford, right? You talk about how in 2001 when he goes to Congress and he scolds both parties for like just fighting and instead of doing the good work of governing. And so I think in this retelling, Ford is almost emerges as a role model, someone who looked for compromise, a kind of middle way, that sort of thing. And that, of course, is kind of in line with sort of an understanding of American politics as
sort of the root cause of all evil is division and polarization, that sort of thing. So talk a little bit about, if that's a fair assessment, like a kind of a reappreciation or a new appreciation of Gerald Ford as a political figure, as a political project, I guess. That would be very interesting to hear.
Can I add an additional question to that, which is about the pardon? Because this also is slightly different, because you seem to... The impression that I got was that your sense is that the pardon was a huge mistake by Ford. And this gets to the point you were just making, Thomas, about accountability, right? And our sense of that here was this moment where Ford just basically let Nixon off the hook. And the American people were like, wait a minute. No, we want this guy to be held accountable for this. And Ford, the institutionalist, ended up making this decision that just fed into this anti-institutionalism. Right, this like resentment of government by giving that pardon to Ford. So anyway, I just wanted to throw that in as well as another how we assess Ford's legacy.
Yeah, let's talk about Gerald Ford. I think a couple of things. I think that, you know, starting with the end of the story first, Thomas was kind of asking about, where we hear Ford sort of lamenting the division that he is seeing. In one sense, there's kind of a classic storytelling thing where it's weird to have Gerald Ford be sort of one of our main people that we're following. And then, of course, when we get to our final episode, he's not in it. And there is an incredible side story about Gerald Ford, by the way, that you guys may know, which is that there's all this speculation that he's going to be Reagan's vice president. You know, a former president is vice president. You know, it's never happened before. And that really kind of consumes the Republican National Convention. And it's one of those things that we just didn't have time to get into. You know, you're making decisions about what matters. And ultimately, that didn't really matter to the topic that we're covering and the themes that we're covering, what was important in that. But it's this absolutely fascinating side story. So thinking about how do we grapple with our story where we've just ended with these other two figures that are sort of the central figures in Ronald Reagan and Jimmy Carter. And so going back to Ford is the sort of a natural storytelling thing on one hand. The other thing was, I think that when I was going back and I'm going through interviews and speeches and archival footage and all those kind of things, I was struck watching footage from the 1990s of Gerald Ford giving interviews on C-SPAN and elsewhere, where he is talking about particularly the Republican Party's sort of grasping of more social issues and the degree to which he does not think they should be doing that. And by that point, Ford is publicly pro-abortion rights. Whereas he'd say sort of taking kind of the muddy middle ground of most candidates during the 1970s when he was president, as abortion is sort of rising as an issue. I will say that I think that if I was able to give more time to that story, I think there's some more nuance in there about Ford, which is that, yeah, you know, he's sort of decrying the division that he sees. There's sort of the both sidesism aspect of it, where he's kind of saying a plague on both their houses, you know, get along, guys. And to some extent, you know, that division, particularly in the 90s with, you know, Newt Gingrich's speaker, this person who kind of comes out of the new right and really kind of weaponizes aspects of Washington in ways that were new. You know, it's like, sure, you can say plagues on both their houses, but it doesn't also mean that those plagues are equal, right? And I think that's the thing that we get into, where you want to avoid both sidesism, but you also want to avoid just, you know, pure partisanship of blaming, you know, one party or another. And I think Ford, to some extent, was guilty of some of that. He also was an old partisan hand. You know, he wanted Republicans to win. He supported Ronald Reagan throughout 1980 and throughout 1984. He was willing to go along with a lot of the things that were happening in the Republican Party because he was an old partisan warrior. And it was only toward the end that you started to hear, I think, a larger theme from him when he was talking publicly. And that was this sort of lamentation of where things were. So I think that, you know, you could come away with sort of a triumphalist note about Ford at the end of our series. And I think that to some extent, it's probably not what I would ultimately like to convey about him. I do think, though, that a lot of reevaluation is in order, because I think that very much when he takes over, he is just dealt the worst hand of cards of any president other than maybe Jimmy Carter. In modern history, I should say, there are other presidents that were handed worse ones. But he, I think, and particularly before he decides to run for president, really is trying to play that hand honestly. And it's interesting to hear the contrast between what our image may be of Gerald Ford and what it is he actually does. So things like that stand out to me are, when he's meeting with the National Women's Political Caucus and the Congressional Black Caucus, organizations that Nixon had very specifically shunned, and he had shunned it for the Southern strategy. He's trying to empower the Republican leaders in the South who have come over from the Democratic Party and, built these new parties. And Ford doesn't want to have any part of that. And I think that that's interesting. I think that that matters. I think that the way that he viewed his role, he named his memoir A Time to Heal. He really thought we got to bring the country together. And whether or not that was possible, I don't know. The degree to which it upsets basically everybody, I think, is sort of fascinating and telling. And I think that the pardon is part of that. I think that the pardon may look different in today's light. I think that you hear what he was looking at, right? And the thing that got to me was the sort of administrative aspect of handing the pardon, which is that he's trying to deal with stagflation and he's trying to deal with foreign policy crises. And you have lawyers coming in saying, oh, we need these files, we need those files. Can you clear off this section? We're going to need a whole bunch of stuff from you. And he's got to keep assigning staff to doing it. And I'm actually pretty sympathetic to management arguments, I think. That's like sort of this undersung aspect of politics. And in some ways, the most important aspect is often how do you manage, not so much, what is your partisanship and what is your policy goals? It's, how do you keep the things functioning? And so I think that from that perspective, the idea of the pardon is sympathetic. It also absolutely tanks him. And again, you never know what would have happened in the negative, but the polls are clear that when people are deciding in a very narrow race between Carter and Ford, that the pardon really seems to be the deciding factor. So, I think Ford's complicated. And I think that he is very different from the image that is often out there, the bumbling kind of dumb guy. I think he is pretty politically savvy. But I also think that we see with Ford what you see from almost every candidate who decides to run for president, which is, sucked in by the race and by wanting to win and by committing so much to it. And so you hear him sort of give way as things go on, as Reagan challenges him, dropping his vice president, telling New York, not in so many words, to drop dead, right? There's that famous the headline saying, Ford to New York dropped dead because New York is bankrupt and Ford says no bailouts. And of course, ultimately he comes to a compromise position to do a bailout. But all of this stuff, he's trying to win and he's trying to figure out how to do it. And ultimately he compromises on the party platform and all these other things. And so I think that it's just, I wouldn't say that I think he's the hero of the story, but I think he's certainly more complicated and worth reevaluating.
I mean, Ben, how dare you give a nuanced, thoughtful, complex answer when you could have just as easily just jumped on the bandwagon and said, boo, polarization, boo, division, boo, boo. And you didn't. Obviously, I'm very happy with how you answered this because I think it's very sort of plausible and a lot more plausible than had you just adopted for landslide, the kind of polarization framework that just very sort of just lays the blame at the feet of two sides that are just two both radicalizing and it's just all about all this division and just never actually questions. Let's look at what actually happens here. And I think the story that you're telling in Landslide is ultimately at its core not really one of polarization. It is one mostly, or at its core, one where one party is basically taken over by sort of this insurgency of radical forces. It's not just one side that you're looking at, to be clear, right? You're also looking at Jimmy Carter, and absolutely, but it is ultimately one party moves hard to one side, elevates radical forces to an extent that we just don't see on the other side. And I think if that is the case, right, if that's what's happening here, then Ford is not a role model, but a cautionary tale also, because he's a reminder of what happens when more moderate establishment forces decide to respond to that challenge of sort of radicalizing radical forces by appeasing them, by adopting and sort of accepting their framing and framework, by making common cause with them, by moving the party platform to the right in order to, I don't know, get the nomination. And again, I'm not saying these are easy. I'm not saying Ford had some other avenues that he could have easily walked down and just easily handled this. That's not what I'm saying. No easy answers ever, probably, in history, right? But what actually happened is the power centers of the Republican Party, the establishment Republicanism, just either dropping out or appeasing the radical forces, making common cause with them. And that certainly did not work, right? Whatever they were trying to do, that is a big part of the story of how we got to where we are today. Too few of them held the line, tried to ostracize these radical forces rather than, again, appease them, get their votes, whatever. And so that is a big part that in that sense, I think, is a cautionary tale, sympathetically told, rightfully so, I think, but a cautionary tale nonetheless.
I think that's really well said. Yeah.
Well, thanks. I think, you know, I know we could go on and on and on about all of this. There's so many aspects and questions we have really only touched on. But Ben, you've already been extremely generous with your time. We should probably conclude soon. I just have basically sort of two concluding questions for you. One is, if you want to, if there is such a thing, tell us about one storyline, just one thing that you explored, but which ultimately sort of ended up on the cutting room floor.
Yeah.
Something that you feel like, hey, this is if there's ever like the B-side publication of Landslide, if we do an extended edition sometime, this is going to be the first thing we're going to put on that, the director's cut, so to speak.
Yeah, I have an Instagram account that I've created very late in the game, just as episodes were coming out, where we can share some of these things. It's at Landslide History. I'm sorry for the quick plug. That's at Landslide History.
We'll plug it again.
There are some outtakes that it's like, oh yeah, you know, really struggled with something or ended up cutting a scene. Talking about Gerald Ford, there is one that maybe made it into the first draft of the first episode and was very quickly cut because it just took us too far afield. But it's a story that I love and I think is fascinating and probably made me more sympathetic toward him in general. And that's the story of Vietnamese refugees. I don't know if you guys know this. So South Vietnam is falling and Ford is making the decisions to pull out the last of the U.S. troops. He had tried to get more funding for Vietnam, not to send U.S. troops over, but to try to prop up South Vietnam, which, you know, but for humanitarian aid. And then, of course, it falls. And you have refugees coming over into the U.S., and that is very unpopular. Most of the population does not want Vietnamese refugees coming to the U.S. and settling around the U.S. And Congress does not want it either. And they're denying aid. And Ford's press secretary describes it as one of the few times he ever remembers Ford swearing, where Ford said those sons of bitches about Congress when they denied aid to it. And so a plane lands in San Francisco carrying 300 plus Vietnamese babies who have been evacuated. And Ford goes himself, and there's the, you know, incredible pictures of him carrying out the babies from the plane. And of course, that's a photo op, but it's a photo op of him doing something that is unpopular at the time. But those images of him carrying out the babies is pretty widely credited with helping turning around public sentiment about the refugees. And going back to talking about sort of signaling from political figures and the power that they can have based on the choices that they make when they take a stand that is unpopular. That to me was sort of a beautiful story, and public sentiment did turn around. And again, you know, who knows, maybe it would have anyway, but you know, he made a choice. It was the choice that defied the public opinion polls, and it ultimately had a really big impact. And so that to me, that was a story that I thought was really touching, and is not one that we get into in the series. And there's a whole lot more like that, of course, not necessarily that are touching like that. Some are, you know, the assassination attempts against Ford, or you know, various other primaries that were interesting and close, you know, the Massachusetts primary where Jimmy Carter stumbles before he wins in Florida, that kind of adds stakes to Florida. But again, you have to kind of choose what can you fit, particularly into an audio story that's going to, if you're going to take a tangent, it better have a point that relates to your core theme. And if you can get to it another way that keeps you in that mainline story, that's probably the course to take, just for people to be able to listen and not be confused.
I believe the very last thing you say, that we hear you say in the show, is what lies ahead, ? Or something like this. I think
thanks for ruining the ending, Thomas.
Huh?
I said thanks for ruining the ending.
Well, yeah, I mean, look.
I'm just kidding. I mean,
yes. It's going to have a whole spoiler warning. This whole thing is going to have a spoiler warning.
I'm just kidding.
I mean, you sound deliberately worried, I guess. And that's the only plausible sort of position to take right now, as we are in the year 2024. So I think I'm not going to ask you to predict what lies ahead for America, because, I mean, who knows, right? We'll talk again in November. But I want to, just as a final question, just want to ask you, what is next for Landslide? It sounded to me, correct me if I'm wrong, that this is the end of the season, but not the series. Is that correct? So there's going to be future seasons. Are you planning on picking up the story in 1980 and continue it? So what is the story you want to keep telling? Or if it's not Landslide season two, what other stories are there in sort of developing in your mind somewhere right now?
Yeah, absolutely. So first of all, we have some bonus episodes that are going to come out that are not the highly produced documentary style stories that have, you know, taken sort of so long to build, but where I do get to talk to people and do some interviews with people about other aspects of the story that we haven't got into in the same way. So the first one of those will come out in a little bit, and that'll be with Mary Ziegler, the historian of abortion, and essentially looking at how abortion as an issue evolves. And I get to use some archival footage that we didn't get to touch on in the mainline series. And of course, abortion, you know, is this fascinating issue that becomes the ultimate wedge issue in American politics. And it sort of is one of those things where, again, you could look at that as a lens for our current division. But in another way, it sort of intersects and diverges from the other things that we look at in the story. And I think it's another one of those issues that is not fated to become what it is today, and is sort of a result of choices that are made in addition to what's happening in the American populace. So, you know, being able to add those kind of conversations, talking a little bit more about campaign finance and the role of dollars. And, you know, we mentioned it in the series, we talk about it a little bit, but not to the depth that I would like. I want to talk more about media. And, you know, we talk about the new right and direct mail as this sort of early form of media for conservatives. But there are these efforts by the new right that are fascinating and sometimes bumbling, and to create some form of television media. And so talking with someone about that and being able to sort of wrap those together. So we're going to have some of those, and those are going to be bonus episodes that are, yeah, a little more lightweight, a little shorter, but where we just get to touch on some of those things. I would love to do another season. I would love to do another season, and I know exactly where I want to go. I want to move forward, and I think that there's sort of, again, going back to my original idea that I was explaining to you guys at the very beginning of the conversation, of sort of taking apart the pieces that lead to today. There is this aspect of this jump of the culture war and the partisanship and sort of the cutthroat tactics from the campaign trail into Washington itself. And looking at that story, and there is a person at the center of that story that we can look to who has a classic tragic arc, who rises up and in political power and becomes one of the most powerful politicians in the country by seizing on this way of weaponizing Washington and empowering the House Ethics Committee and doing all these things until eventually those same forces he's empowered oust him. And of course, that's Newt Gingrich. And I would love to do that story. And I think that there's incredible stories within there. So the question is, how do we make it happen during a very difficult time in podcasting, in the podcast industry? So that's what I'm looking at now. I mean, that's sort of the next thing to sort of turn my attention to and figure out how can we put that together. And so the last sort of plug that I have on that, if you don't mind, is that essentially on our website, we're collecting emails from people who might be interested in that. So that's my company, my little LLC is Nuance Tales, like, Nuance and then Tales like story.com. And we have a little email place for people who are interested in future seasons to be able to drop in their emails. And so, that's sort of where things stand. Bonus episodes, would love to do future episodes about it. And I've really enjoyed like telling the story. It's been so fun for me. It's a really rare opportunity for a journalist to get this much time and to learn this in depth about something new. So I've loved it and I would love to do more.
I think that sounds absolutely fantastic. Not just the bonus episode, but also a story of that sort of really, really sort of zooms in on the example, maybe one of the key examples of these powerful leaders on the right sort of trying and always failing to harness this sort of extremist right-wing populist energies on the base and on the right to their own, sort of make it work for themselves while staying in charge. And they always fail. They always think they can harness them and control them and only use them to their own ends. And they always fail. And the only thing that ever happens is that the Republican Party radicalizes further to the right. And ultimately, again, this happens again with Trump. This is, in many ways, I think, the story about sort of right-wing politics. And the 90s, early 90s, is such a key moment in that story, a sort of post-Cold War moment. And figures like Gingrich, they capture and they encapsulate that, they embody that. That would be absolutely fantastic. I think, Seth, that's you and I, we certainly want to hear that, right?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, rethinking Reagan is going to be a really important task for us in our public memory, right, as a nation. You know, so much of the kind of never Trump shock in 2016 was built around a really misleading perception of who Reagan was, right, and what Reaganism was. And that's why they were shocked, right? And meanwhile, you know, all of the folks who basically left the Republican Party after when G.W. Bush showed up, and then returned with Trump, right? Those were the people who thought they owned the party, right? And for whom Trump was a deliverance, for whom Sarah Palin was kind of brought them back in and was sort of a deliverance. And so there's these different trajectories of who the Republican Party is. And I think Reagan is just this really interesting kind of combination mixture, this kind of unicorn of a political figure, you know, who is able to kind of harness some of this stuff. And so getting a clear grasp of who he was and what the dynamics were that produced him, I think, is hugely important. And the podcast, I think, does a great job of that, of, you know, I don't feel like you're unfair to him, but I feel like it's an unsparing sort of account of who he was and what he was doing.
I know everyone who listened to Landslide, everyone who hopefully will listen to Landslide, everyone who listened to our conversation that we just had here will agree that we are eagerly awaiting the next chapters in this story. We would love to have you back on the podcast, Ben, to discuss all this whenever it comes out. Once again, I mean, I'll say this to everyone who listens to us. If you haven't yet, go find Landslide, all 7 episodes, wherever you get your podcasts. Seth and I certainly highly recommend it. And keep an eye out for everything Ben and his team at Nuance Tales do. Again, we'll put links in the show notes so that people can just click on it and find your work. I thank you both. I thank you, Seth. Thank you, Ben, for doing this. Again, we recorded for a long time. This was great fun and I think really clarifying on so many levels. And this is going to be our show. So we will be back soon, I hope. Until then, bye-bye.